everybody. It's Dr. Amy Myers. Just wanted to welcome you back to the latest episode of The Myers Way, and happy 2014. This is our first podcast, I believe, in 2014, and I am very excited with our latest guest that I'm having on today, Chris Kresser. I'm sure many of you all know who he is, and he has just launched his newest book, Your Personal Paleo Code. Chris, welcome.
Thanks, Amy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. I mean, I know I always say I'm really excited to hear about my guest, you know, talk to my guest. And I am genuinely excited to talk to you about your book because I was fortunate enough to get an early copy of this. You'd sent it to me and was reading it over the holidays. And it really, as you and I were just kind of talking right before this, I really, you know, just was reading and thinking this is, I mean, my first thought was this is really well written. And I don't mean that to sound just kind of, you know, ho-hum, but as I was also saying to you, I mean, I read obviously a lot of books in our field, and either they're kind of what I perceive might be over somebody's head or almost even dumbed down too much. And I really feel like you really hit it on the mark in terms of having the research and laying it out in a way that, you know, is really easy to read and engaging and interesting. So I'm excited to talk to you about it.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, first, I always like to ask my guests kind of how they got into this, because most of us that practice functional medicine or in the paleo world typically have a personal story, and I think you do as well.
Yeah, definitely, and I think it's really true that a lot of people in the world of health, whether it's functional medicine or something else, got there through sheer necessity, really. I think for me, it was a combination of a lifelong interest in health and then an episode when I was traveling in my early 20s where I got extremely ill in Asia while I was doing some surfing in Indonesia. And that then evolved into like a decade-long, very mysterious, complex, chronic, and debilitating illness and journey back to health. And, you know, there's a lot that happened during that period, of course, but one of the pivotal turning points for me was discovering what I didn't know then was called a paleo diet, but that's what I was doing. And then, you know, kind of tweaking it, personalizing it, customizing it to meet my own needs. And then, of course, that became the impetus for my book.
And you also, you didn't have any formal training at that point, from what I understand, and you actually went back and got an acupuncture degree. Is that correct?
Yeah. So when I was at one point during that journey, I actually considered going back to medical school and was thinking about doing a post-bac pre-med program. And I went out and interviewed about 10 different doctors in my area and asked them, and this was kind of before functional medicine was, I knew about it. So I was just interviewing like, conventional doctors in conventional practices and asked them if they enjoyed practicing medicine, they would do it again if they could do it all over again. And 9 out of 10 of them said no. And the 10th one was sort of, equivocal about it. And then of course I had experienced most of my improvements through, what we could call unconventional medicine. And so that's what I was more drawn to ultimately. And I went back and I studied integrative and functional medicine through a program in California, the acupuncture and Chinese medicine providers were licensed in the workers' comp system. So we have to know a lot of conventional or allopathic medicine in order to be able to be in that system. So we have kind of these really long 4-year master's programs that have a lot of the typical conventional medicine, anatomy, physiology, pharmacology, all that sort of stuff. And then we have the alternative medicine curriculum as well. So it was a great experience. And that's when I started to kind of learn more about how to interpret the research and read studies and critique them and analyze them. And that's been a big part of my writing and my own exploration.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that you're really known for and that you do really so well is analyzing the research and really using the data. And I think you do a great job of that in your book as well. And I think it's great. You know, I frequently get people coming to me and asking about if they should go to medical school. And I mean, I always tell people, particularly when they're older, like I think you and I both were when we were doing our paths, that you really got to think about it. I mean, I tell people there are so many ways that you can do this and help people without actually going to medical school, and that you really, really have to be, you know, invested in it. And, you know, I think certainly medical school played a role in my health issues. I mean, I'm really glad now that I'm on this end and I'm doing what I'm doing. And I went in like you did with the intention of doing, you know, not traditional medicine, but I have had plenty of people come chat with me about, you know, going to med school and then, you know, email me back or write me back and tell me that they've chosen some other path like acupuncture or nutrition or something like that, because, you know, it's frequently, my brother-in-law actually is a anesthesia resident right now. And, they do not let them get up and go to the bathroom. And he, when he's on his rotations for cardiac and whatnot, I mean, these surgeries could be 10, 12, 14 hours long, and literally they cannot, I mean, he can't leave the room. Like, how is that healthy, right?
I mean, yeah, exactly.
You know? So he doesn't drink water so he won't have to pee. And I'm just like, yeah, our healthcare system is really, you know, out there producing people, you know, healing people. So anyway, well, tell us a little bit about the book. What was your, you know, I mean, I know paleo is obviously one of the things that you're most passionate about and write frequently about, but tell us really, what was your mission in writing this book?
Well, I think my mission was to address some of the criticisms that have been levied against paleo, some of which I partially agree with, actually, number one, and in order to make paleo more accessible to the mainstream, because it's been an incredibly powerful niche movement so far, but it really hasn't penetrated into the mainstream. And that's, I mean, let's face it, the mainstream is what needs the most help, right? It's awesome to see such a like grassroots groundswell of a movement in the you know, paleo niche in the health and fitness community, but I really want to see these concepts get out to a wider audience. So that was one of my main goals. Another goal was to address actually what I see as some of the misconceptions or myths within the paleo framework itself. For example, the idea that we shouldn't eat grains or dairy simply because our ancestors didn't eat them. I don't think that's a valid enough reason on its own, and we can talk more about that. And then the third major reason I would say would be to communicate the importance of personalizing paleo to meet each person's individual needs. And I know you know all about that as a clinician, but I think what I saw a lot in my practice and also just in my involvement in the community was people that were following a kind of rigid idea of what paleo, or they thought paleo was supposed to be. And that was causing a lot of problems for them. And we do share a lot in common as human beings, but we're also very different in some important ways. And all of those differences can go into what makes the dietary approach for each individual unique. And that's what I really wanted to communicate in the book. I basically wanted to teach people how to discover their own optimal diet rather than following what some guru, including me, says.
Right. Yeah. And that's so important. And I think, you know, that's one of the things that in functional medicine, we're always advocating is, you know, what is the right thing for you? Because it's not, you know, it's not the right thing for everybody. Well, let's kind of talk about that, because there are, you know, people out there eating vegan diets and vegetarian diets, and they're, you know, at least perceived that they're doing great on these diets. But you kind of really talk about how, you know, for the most part, most people probably really aren't doing well on that type of diet.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because people always, I mean, that's another sort of criticism you'll hear or question whenever anyone brings up the fact that vegetarian and vegan diets can often lead to nutrient deficiencies and health problems. Someone will say, well, I just switched to a vegetarian diet and I feel great, you know, or a vegan diet or whatever, what have you. And I have a couple answers to that. Number one is it depends what you're switching from.
Yeah.
You know, if you were eating cheese doodles and drinking big gulps and eating chocolate chip cookies all day and all kinds of other processed and refined crap, and you switch to a vegetarian diet that emphasizes primarily whole foods, you know, vegetables, fruits, eggs, maybe some dairy, whole grains and legumes, of course you're going to feel better.
Right.
You just went from eating, non-food that's incredibly nutrient poor to foods that have a lot of beneficial nutrients. So that makes sense. You're going to feel better. And that feeling better might go on for quite a while, actually, because as you know, Amy, that there are a lot of nutrient deficiencies. Nutrients are stored in our body, and deficiencies can take a while to develop. So it's not like you switch to a vegetarian diet and you become deficient in these nutrients overnight. It doesn't work that way, especially if you've been eating other more nutrient-dense foods before that. So that's one answer. The second answer is that I think there are certain genetic and perhaps epigenetic factors that make some people more susceptible to the potential health challenges that come from a vegetarian or vegan diet than others. So some examples would be, we have beta carotene is a precursor to the active form of vitamin A, retinol, which is so crucial for proper function. And we have the ability, in theory, to convert beta carotene, which you get from plant foods, into vitamin A, retinol, which you only get really from animal foods, especially organ meats. But that conversion varies a lot from person to person. So if you get one person who can hardly make that conversion at all, then they're going to develop, and they are on a plant-based diet, or even eating meats, but never really eating organ meats or taking cod liver oil, they're going to be prone to vitamin A deficiency, and pretty quickly. Whereas if you have somebody that can make that conversion well, then they may ultimately still end up with the suboptimal levels of vitamin A, but it's going to take them a lot longer to get there. That's just one example. There are a lot of other examples. The main issue with vegetarian, vegan, and particularly vegan diets is that they are deficient in certain nutrients, which we know are crucial for proper health and function. And I think one of the biggest is EPA and DHA, which are the long chain omega-3 fats. And this is another example where it's possible, in theory, to convert some of the plant-based omega-3s that you find in like walnuts and flaxseed oil and things like that into these longer chain omega-3s that have the health benefits. But that conversion is extremely limited, even in healthy people. So I'll give you a specific number, less than 0.5% of alpha-linolenic acid, which is the omega-3 you find in plants, gets converted into DHA in a healthy person. Mm-hmm. That's when all systems are go, all the enzymes are working well. And of course, those enzymes require nutrients that also tend to be deficient in a vegetarian diet. So the typical vegetarian will not be converting even 0.5%. And, you have to drink an enormous amount of flaxseed oil in order to convert, to get the recommended amount of DHA. And, if you do that, you're going to probably have to stay close to a bathroom.
Yeah.
Like a cup of flaxseed oil a day is going to have a real laxative effect. So
yeah,
DHA and EPA, I think, are the biggest issues, in part because you can't, a strict vegetarian can't supplement with EPA and DHA because it's fish
right.
oil,
yeah.
know? So like B12 is another big issue for vegetarians and vegans, but they can, they can supplement with B12 and offset that, some of that disadvantage. I think it's better to get nutrients from food, but at least it's possible for them to do it without violating, their ethical principles if that's why they're doing a vegetarian or vegan diet in the first place. But there's no easy way to replace the EPA and DHA. There is now a microalgae DHA supplement that you can take to get the DHA, and some DHA can be retro-converted into EPA, but it's extremely expensive and hard to find. So it's, it's not an optimal solution for most people.
Yeah, and then, with algaes, you have to be really careful about the source of those algaes.
Absolutely. So there's the EPA and DHA. There's B12, which most people think, oh, you know, B12 deficiency is not that big of a problem, because some of the early studies showed that, you know, something like 10-15% of vegetarians were B12 deficient, which, yeah, I mean, that's a significant number, but it's not the overwhelming majority. The problem is those early studies used methods of detecting B12 deficiency that were not very sensitive. And the newer studies that use much more sensitive methods like urinary methylmalonic acid and homocysteine, holotranscobalamin, and some of the more advanced markers, they have found rates of deficiency, B12 deficiency, of over 85% in vegans, I think. I'm going by memory here. And I think over 65 or 70% in vegetarians. So that changes the equation considerably, because it means that the majority of both vegetarians and vegans are B12 deficient. And you know, Amy, how serious B12 deficiency can be.
Right. And I mean, I have plenty of people who aren't even, you know, vegans and vegetarians that are coming in B12 deficient by using the latter methods that you're referring to, you know, and that gets into the MTHFR and, you know, are you digesting and absorbing? Do you have small bowel bacterial overgrowth? I mean, as you know, all the things, you know, you can be getting it, you know, as we both always say, you know, it's not you are what you eat, but it's what you are, what you digest and absorb. So you can, I mean, I even see people coming in from the paleo community and they're, you know, eating all this really great stuff, and then but they're just, so many things are going wrong in their gut that they're not able to digest and absorb what they're bringing in.
Yeah, and then there's this whole PPI issue, the acid suppressing drugs that decrease our absorption of many nutrients, including B12, and those are some of the most commonly prescribed drugs in the US. So that's another problem, even for people eating animal products.
Right. We could go on and on about the whole host of reasons and how people are not digesting and absorbing these vital nutrients even while eating, you know, a really great diet. So, well, let's get back to, you know, just kind of, I think one of the things that I really liked about the book was exactly what you had talked about, debunking a lot of myths. And, you know, what about the fact that people say, you know, well, cavemen died, you know, so young, and we live so long now. So, you know, clearly the agricultural revolution, you know, has impacted our health and extended our life.
Yeah. So on the surface, that sounds like a compelling argument. But when you look a little deeper, it kind of falls apart. It's definitely true that on average, our lifespans, the lifespans of our ancestors were shorter than our own. But those averages don't take into account really important challenges that our ancestors faced that we are not facing today. And that includes things like high rates of infant mortality, violence, trauma, warfare, exposure to the elements, and a complete lack of any kind of significant emergency medical care, or any medical care at all. So some interesting studies that were done by anthropologists Guervin and Kaplan down in South America found that contemporary hunter-gatherer populations that had even the most rudimentary access to emergency medical care and weren't dealing with all of those factors that I just mentioned live lifespans that were close to our own. But the difference is they reach those ages without acquiring any of the chronic inflammatory diseases that characterize our old age, like obesity, diabetes, heart disease, gout, autoimmune conditions, et cetera. These populations are virtually free of those conditions. So the longer lifespan wasn't due to the agricultural revolution, wasn't due to a healthier diet and lifestyle. It actually happened in spite of a much less healthy diet and lifestyle, largely because of advances in medical care and reduction in deaths due to trauma, violence, infection, things like that.
Yeah. When we're talking about meats and vegetarianism, often I get the comment, well, I read the China study, and ever since then, you know, I'm not eating meat. I mean, all, you know, meat causes cancer and dairy causes cancer. Do you have kind of a rebuttal to the China study?
Denise Minger, who's also a colleague in the paleo primal real food community has written probably the most lengthy, sharp, punishing rebuttal of the China study that I, you know, anyone could ever write. And I'm definitely not going to surpass that. And the level of detail there is just really, she has a great summary on her website too. But in short,
what's her website, just real quick? Do you know?
I don't know off the top of my head. If you Google Denise Minger, okay. I think raw food SOS, or I think might be her website. The basic thing to consider with any kind of nutritional research and epidemiology is which the China study is based on, is that correlation does not equal causation. So this means that you can, you know, when they do a kind of epidemiological nutritional study, what they look at two groups, or they look at a big group of people, and they say, okay, so this group of people was eating more red meat, and they also had higher rates of cancer, heart disease, et cetera. And then they try to conclude from that it's eating the red meat that caused those higher rates of cancer and heart disease. But there's a big problem with drawing that conclusion from this kind of research, and that's something called the healthy user effect. So red meat has been seen as unhealthy, and this isn't so much relevant to the China study, but just in general nutritional research, especially in the U.S., red meat has been seen as unhealthy for so long that people who, outside of the paleo movement at least, who eat more red meat are more likely to engage in behaviors that are actually unhealthy. Because if they've demonstrated a willingness to, you know, eat, quote, unhealthy red meat, then they're probably doing other things like smoking, physical, not exercising enough, and you know, things that actually are problematic. And there's no way of piecing out in these studies whether it's those factors that are increasing their risk of disease and death or the red meat. There are better studies, though, that you can do to answer those questions. And for example, one study that I saw try to control for that healthy user effect by looking only at people who shopped in health food stores. So these are people who, there's not a guarantee that they have a higher level of health awareness, but it's pretty likely that they do by the nature of where they're shopping. And they found that, as you might suspect, that people who shop in health food stores have longer lifespans on average than people who don't shop in health food stores. But they found that there was no difference at all in the lifespans of people who eat meat and people who are vegetarians who shop in health food stores. So that was one of the better, more ingenious ways of dealing with this problem that I've seen in the research. But then there have been a lot of other studies that have directly looked at the relationship between red meat consumption and cardiovascular disease and death that have found no association at all. So the problem with the China study is it was written by an author who's been a longtime vegetarian, an advocate for that type of lifestyle, and he set out with an argument and a point to make, and really massaged the research to appear that it made that point. But when you look under the hood at the actual research, as many people now have, you'll see that it doesn't support that idea at all.
Yeah, I love the paper that you quoted in the book, which you also just now talked about the shopping in the health food stores. And, you know, then when you sort of looked at it from that perspective, that there really was no difference between the meat eater and the non-meat eater. And I just found that study fairly interesting and a different, you know, kind of way to look at things.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I mean, that's, you know, there's a big group in town that advocates a vegan lifestyle and does these immersion programs. And they invited me to one, and I sat down with the, you know, leading physicians of it and whatnot. And, you know, just talked about kind of what you said from the beginning. If you're the person who was eating Twinkies and then you got on a vegetarian or vegan diet and they're feeling better, like you substituted junk food or non-food for food. And then, you know, then they're quoting their studies of, you know, getting people off cholesterol medicine and diabetes medicine. I'm like, I can do the exact same thing on a paleo diet. I mean, you're just giving people real food, you know. And then when you get into autoimmune diseases, you know, your diet, in my opinion, wouldn't work for those people because, you know, you have eaten whole grain cereal cereal for breakfast, and that's just not gonna, for most people, that wouldn't work. So I've tried to talk to them about having a, if this doesn't work and you have autoimmune part to their program, let me come talk. But yeah, it would be in like complete opposition to what they're saying. Not really. I mean, at the end of the day, we're all advocating real food and, you know, vegetables and whatnot. It's just, you know, some of us have meat and some don't. Well, along those lines, I mean, I think another huge myth about, you know, eating meat is about the cholesterol and heart disease. So can you kind of talk about that?
Sure. So that's another case where there was some early studies that suggested an association or correlation between higher meat and fat intake and then higher cholesterol levels and higher levels of heart disease. But once again, you have to really be careful not to assume that just because two variables are related, there's a causal relationship between one and the other. And then the other thing was just the quality and size of some of the early studies wasn't that great, and some of the larger recent studies have been much better performed, larger sample sizes, which means the results are more reliable. So in terms of the first idea, which is that eating dietary cholesterol and saturated fat raises the cholesterol levels in your blood, that turns out to be not true for most people. So taking cholesterol first, they've done some very well-controlled egg feeding studies where the only variable they change is feeding. They split people into two groups, and one group gets fed 2 to 4 eggs a day. And egg yolks, of course, can contain substantial amount of cholesterol. And then they measure people's cholesterol at the end of the study. And what they found is that in 70% of people, there was no discernible change in their cholesterol levels from eating the eggs, no change whatsoever. In 30% of people that they called hyper responders, there was a slight increase in LDL, which is the so-called bad cholesterol from eating eggs, but there was a corresponding increase in HDL, which is the so-called good cholesterol, that kind of canceled out the clinical significance of the LDL going up. So what we can say is that eating eggs either has no effect on your cholesterol or it has an effect that's not clinically significant and not likely to impact the risk of heart disease. In terms of saturated fat, it's a similar story, although maybe a little bit more complicated. Most of the studies that have examined the relationship between saturated fat consumption and cholesterol, the more recent, bigger studies have found that there's no association on average. Now, some of the problem with looking at these big studies and looking at averages is that we don't treat averages in the clinic. We treat patients. We treat individuals. And there are definitely some individuals who do experience an increase in cholesterol when they eat more saturated fat. And I'm sure you've seen this, Amy, but the patient that switches to a paleo diet, a lower carb paleo diet, higher fat intake, and comes to us really concerned that their cholesterol levels have gone up by 100 points since they made that change. So it does happen. There are some many potential reasons for that that we probably don't have time to go into now that should be investigated, things like poor thyroid function or metabolic syndrome, insulin resistance, infections, leaky gut, small bowel bacterial overgrowth, et cetera. But it is true that some people just simply have a genetic predisposition to experience an increase in cholesterol from eating saturated fat. The more important question, though, is who cares? Does it matter? Does it have a clinically significant impact on rates of heart disease or your risk of having a heart attack? So as I mentioned, the studies, there are lots of studies that look at the relationship between saturated fat and cholesterol. And the idea with those studies is, we all know that high cholesterol leads to heart attacks. So if we establish that saturated fat increases cholesterol, then it goes without saying that saturated fat increases heart attacks. But that's actually not a foregone conclusion. And the best way to find out if saturated fat increases the risk of heart disease would be to simply study the relationship between those two things and knock out cholesterol as an intermediate variable. So there are many studies, as it turns out, that have looked at that. Just does eating more saturated fat increase the risk of heart attacks? And you might be surprised to learn that in the majority of cases, it does not. So the research on this issue is a lot more nuanced than most people understand, than the mainstream paradigm makes it out to be. And in the majority of cases, eating, you know, a whole foods nutrient dense diet that contains, you know, naturally occurring amounts of saturated fat in foods is going to be not have a significant impact on cholesterol in most people. And even if it does affect cholesterol, it's not in a way that's going to increase the risk of heart attacks.
Yeah, and you mentioned, you know, seeing that clinically, and I would say that only in the few people that I've had that have actual, you know, familial hypercholesterolemia have I seen, you know, really eating a paleo diet or specifically eggs. I mean, we actually did track it down to eggs. We kind of took eggs in, took it out, that increased their cholesterol. But otherwise, you know, because I'm typically working, as you are, to sort of fix the gut and do all, you know, clear the infections and thyroid and all that other stuff, I really haven't seen people switching over to a paleo diet, increasing their cholesterol at all. Well, you are really known for, or at least I think so, you know, the talking about how bad sitting is for us. And I know that as you wrote your book, you had a treadmill desk. I actually just ordered one. That was my gift to myself as I write my book. So it should be here next week. I'm super excited, but I am standing at my little standing desk as we do this podcast. But tell us about that, because, you know, many people out there are, you know, just out of necessity sitting all day at their desk.
Yeah. So there's been a great sort of media slogan lately. I've seen there was one story, I can't remember where it originated, that I'm definitely stealing the title of, and it was called Is Sitting the New Smoking? And I think that's a great way to kind of communicate the increasing awareness of the risks of sitting. We didn't evolve to spend most of our days sitting in chairs. I think that probably goes without saying, but it's a good reminder. We evolved in a natural environment where we were physically active throughout the day. We had to move in order to gather and hunt our food. We had to move to build shelters. We had to move from one place to the next. We were moving a lot. And certainly there were periods of rest. And in contemporary hunter-gatherer cultures, they actually emphasize the importance of rest quite a bit. I mean, I don't think about it or talk about it necessarily that way, but when they're not moving, they do rest. But they move a lot more than the average American does today. And you know, a lot of people might be thinking, oh, well, that's not that big of a deal because, yeah, I do sit at a desk for most of the day, but I exercise three times. I go to the gym and I do my half hour of moderate intensity activity, and so I should be fine, right? Well, the problem with that is that increasing amount of research shows that even if you're getting that amount, the recommended amount of moderate exercise each week, you're still at risk. Greater risk for disease and early death if you're sitting for excessive amounts of time, you know, for the large majority of each day. So in the book, I talk about a lot of different strategies for how to mitigate that risk if you do work in a job where you have to sit in your office and you're not, you know, not everyone we realize has the ability to get a standing desk. I think a lot more work employers are becoming hip to this. And as soon as they figure out how much lower their healthcare bills are going to be for employees, they will adopt it as soon as they possibly can. But there are simply still environments where it's not practical and people are stuck working at a desk. So in those cases, you can do things like set reminders. There are some applications on the computer that can help with this, like Timeout for the Mac or Workrave for the PC, that will automatically remind you periodically to stand up and take a break. I recommend there's a study that showed every 40 minutes, if you stand up, even for 2 minutes and walk around and come back to your chair, that can largely mitigate some of the risk from sitting for really long periods. You can do things like take walking meetings whenever possible. A lot more people are doing that now. You can, if you commute to work in a car, you can park a mile away from your work and walk the rest of the way and then walk back. That's another way to just get some extra activity into your day. You can do things like take the stairs whenever possible instead of the elevator or the escalator. So when you're looking for opportunities for physical activity, they tend to, you know, you can find them. Where there's a will, there's a way. Doing yard work, chores around the house instead of outsourcing that stuff. So there's lots of opportunities, even if you have a primarily sedentary job.
Yeah, those are great tips. My former neighbor was a therapist, and she offered walking therapy sessions, which I thought was a great idea, you know, kind of killed two birds with one stone. I mean, obviously, if you're in, you know, distress, maybe you don't feel comfortable displaying your emotions, but I thought it was a really just brilliant idea.
Yeah.
And then for those that are looking for just a super cheap fix. When I had back trouble, I think 2 years ago, I was looking for a standing desk and they were all just outside of my budget. Mm-hmm. So I thought about this, just the literally the trays that they use in the hospital at the hospital desk.
Yeah.
They're 50 bucks on Amazon. If you just Google,
cool.
I mean, that's what I'm at right now. And so I just use it at my house with a laptop, and it's where I'll often, you know, even stand and, you know, on my computer when I'm at home. Now I'll have my treadmill desk. But anyway, I mean, it's a $50 fix for people, and they're relatively small, that if you have the space in your office. What I was doing, obviously when I had patients in my office, I was sitting with them. And then when I had phone calls, which probably half of my patient follow-ups are on the phone, I would switch to this, and it can just sit over in the corner. And I mean, for 50 bucks. So if you just Google, I think it's like hospital tray or something, it will come up for you.
Where there's a will, there's a way.
Yeah. I mean, I was like, I am not spending $2,000 on a desk. There's got to be some better way. And, you know, I know there are people who do makeshifts and things like that. But, I mean, literally it has a little lever. So you can rise it or, you know, raise it or lower it depending on how high you are or whatever.
Yeah.
So I thought it was pretty brilliant for me for, you know, the $50 fix. So.
That's great. However it works is the best way to do it. And there, like you said, if you just do a little searching around, there are a lot of, like DIY standing desk. Even my setup is sort of, you know, a little bit DIY. I have a standing desk that I got for about $200, I think. And then I have a treadmill that's just the tread itself. It doesn't have like any rails or any interface, or, you know, it's not like a big, huge treadmill. It's just the treadmill part. And I slide that under the standing desk. And then the only other things I ended up needing to do was I got a keyboard tray that comes out from under the desk that just improves the ergonomics of it a little bit, because I was spending pretty long periods of time there while I was writing the book. But that's, you know, you can do it in a piecemeal fashion, it's completely, you can set it up any number of different ways depending on your financial circumstances and the, you know, the logistics of your space.
Yeah, for sure. Well, one final question, because I know we're almost out of time here. I mean, one of the other things that you talk about in your book that I haven't seen in a lot of other paleo type books or even functional medicine books is just really talking about sort of the less tangible aspects, which are, you know, play and touch and human connection and the power of all of those things in healing. So can you just kind of give us a little overview on that?
Sure. Yeah, I'm a huge, huge believer in the importance of those things. And once again, that partly came from my own life experience and my own experience with illness. At one point in that long 10, 11 year process, about halfway through, maybe a little over halfway through, I had tried everything you can possibly imagine and was still quite sick and just feeling really demoralized. And I realized that I needed, until then I had been mostly focusing on nutrition, supplements, medications, trying everything along those lines. I was also paying some attention to lifestyle, but it just became clear that I needed to take a step back from the intense focus on the nutrition piece and really bring some attention and energy to just enjoying my life because my life, prior to that had been really hard and a lot of struggle and pain and difficulty. And so I kind of created a program. I was already aware of a lot of the research suggesting that pleasure released endorphins, and endorphins help regulate the immune system and promote health in a number of ways. I was aware, I had read a book about play and how important play is to stress management and maintaining a positive outlook, which in turn has beneficial impacts on the immune system. So I created a kind of pleasure play stress management program where I just really focused on having fun, listening to music that I like, getting regular massage, taking walks with friends, going out and spending time with friends, watching funny movies or reading funny books, things that made me laugh out loud, spending a lot of time in nature, which has always been really healing for me, making sure I had plenty of time to sleep, and just really focus on bringing as much joy and pleasure into my life as possible. And that was another big turning point for me. Certainly discovering a paleo type of approach to eating was huge, but this also was, I would say, probably equally profound in terms of the effect that it had on me. And so I naturally became interested in all even more and learning more about the mechanisms behind those things and how they work. And that's why I wanted to share it in the book.
Awesome. Well, if people want to get a copy of your book, I'm sure they can get that through your website, pretty much any online book retailer I see. Mm-hmm. You have a massive book tour coming up, so you guys need to check out his website at chriscresser.com, and on the right you'll see a list of where he'll be. He'll be here in Austin on Monday, January 20th. I'm planning on going. I think my whole office is coming. So cool. If anybody else wants to come, get on, and there's a place to sign up to go hear Chris. Definitely get a copy of the book, everybody. It really is one of the best written books that I've read in a while. And he really does cover a lot of those myths and facts that everybody's kind of wondering about. So, I mean, just excellent job, Chris. I really appreciate you writing the book and being on our podcast today.
Thanks, Amy. I'm really grateful for the opportunity, and I look forward to seeing you in Austin.
Yeah, absolutely. And so everybody, chriscresser.com, and then your personal paleocode.com as well has a lot of information about how to get the book and, you know, sign up to get updates from Chris and whatnot. Well, congratulations. Good luck on all of your upcoming travel. I hope it all goes smoothly and that it's extremely successful for you.
Thanks again.
All right. Take care.
You too.
Bye.
To stay in touch with Dr. Myers, you can sign up for her newsletter on her website at dramymyers.com or connect with her on Facebook or Twitter at Amy Myers MD.